Okay, thank you. The committee will come to order.
I don't know.
There is a quorum present. Okay, the first show we'll be considering today, we're just doing some cleanup work for from the bills that were left over from last year that passed out of committee and didn't pass the floor. So, Representative Thiessen, do you want to come up first? Would somebody on the committee move for you?
I'll move House File 117 first.
Thank you, Representative Bigham. Representative Thiessen, you might as well go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I got an email that there's a technical cleanup amendment. I think you need to change the date from 07 to 08, the effective date. So I on line 2.1, it would be effective August 1st, 2008, instead. If someone could move that for me.
I assume Representative Bigham moves the A1 amendment.
Yes, I'll move the amendment.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill was heard last year at the beginning of the session, and it really does one thing. In our personal jurisdiction statute, in general, what this statute has been interpreted to mean is that you have to satisfy due process provisions of the Constitution. We do make one exception for causes of action and defamation of privacy, and only in circumstances where the defamer lives in another state, but the effect of the defamation is Minnesota. So if someone sends a letter from out of state or publishes something on the internet from out of state and it hurts the individual who lives in Minnesota, Minnesota courts don't have any jurisdiction over that person from out of state. And I don't really see that there's any reason that that should be the case, why there should be that kind of narrow exception. So that's what this bill, it would just put those cases of defamation of privacy on par with every other type of tort we have in Minnesota.
Any short discussion? Okay. Is there a witness? Did you want to... Any witness on this? Okay. Then all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Bill passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next one is 1130. Is Representative Nelson...
I can move House File 1113 for Representative Nelson.
1130.
Thank you. Just Representative Nelson, just a second. I guess I've been just informed that the motion is to take it off the table, I guess. So I assume Representative Bigham makes that motion.
Yeah, I will move to take it off, take 1130 off the table.
Thank you, Representative Bigham. Go ahead, Representative Nelson.
I understand that's there's also a... Mr. Chair? Am I ready to go, or...?
Yes.
Okay, I was just... Mr. Chair, I understand there's also a technical amendment we have to do to it. And I had the AO3 amendments. I don't know why the AO2 amendments there, because that's incorporated in AO3, or A3, excuse me. On page 1, line 2, after delete, or an attorney. And then on line, or page 2, line 1, delete 07, 207, and put in 2008.
And Representative Nelson, my understanding is the first one, the or an attorney, was also added last year by an oral amendment. Is that correct? Or was...
My mind foggy on that.
Okay.
He believes it was taken out last year.
Okay. Oh, it was taken out last year?
Yeah.
Okay. The delete.
Yeah.
Okay, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Carries by 2-0. Okay, go ahead, Representative Nelson.
Anyway, I have Cassandra O'Hearn here with me from the... from the Department of Public Safety. Yes, my brain's not fully functioning at this morning also. And basically what the bill is we...
Representative Nelson. It's afternoon.
Exactly. And as this this bill was presented last year, and it was basically non-controversial, although I guess it became more controversial than I thought. The individuals that had questions about it last year and never came back to see me and talk to me. But basically what it does is individuals that are reporting false information or to police officers, there's a currently a statute on the bill or on the book. And what this does is some departments that are smaller, these reports are taken by non-police officers, and it extends the same criminal penalties to people that give those false reports to non-police officers. And for Representative Cornish, I... But anyway, that's the meat of the bill, and like I said, it's basically a non-controversial bill, and if anybody has any questions...
Representative Nelson, what you don't know is Representative Cornish has been practicing skeet shooting this week. He's ready for that action. Is there any discussion of this bill? Okay. Yes, Representative Bigham moves that the bill be taken from the table and passed to General Register, I believe. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. The next bill we'll take up is Representative...
Mr. Chair, Mr. Tennyson and representatives from the Public Defender's Office are still conversing about another possible amendment to this bill, so if we could progress this.
Okay.
If there's time at the end, take it up. If not, move it to the next meeting.
Oh, okay. We'll just... We don't... progress it in this committee, but we'll just take it up later on the hearing today, and then if you want to just lay it over till next meeting. Okay. Then Representative Quayle, 1595.
Good afternoon.
Okay. Good afternoon. Representative, does somebody want to? Are you moving the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move the bill. I move that the bill be passed and referred to the General Register, I believe.
Yes.
And take it from the table. Yeah.
What?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The committee last year did give us a hearing, and so we are here again this year hoping that we can make it to the General Register for consideration. I have with me several advocates for this issue, and if it's possible for them to speak, I would be very appreciative.
Representative Swales, we'll take short-term testimony. If you want to either he or you quickly explain the bill. And
sure. Would you like to explain it?
I certainly can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
You have to state your name, sir.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. The bill, House File 15...
sir, you have to state your name.
Oh, I am sorry. My name is Fred Jacoberger. I am an attorney. I practice in and live in Bloomington, Minnesota. For about the past 5 years, an increasing amount of my practice has been devoted to representing homeowners in cases involving construction defects, water intrusion, and mold. And the reason that has happened is because there's simply so much of it around. There's an astounding number of homes built in Minnesota in the last 15 to 20 years that are defective. And there's an astounding number of homeowners that are put in a great deal of a pinch because of this, who, like most of us, stretch to buy their homes to raise their families in, and later, through no fault of their own, find that the asset they have borrowed heavily to buy and invested heavily to buy is either worthless or worth a great deal less than they thought it would have been, or that it would have been had it been constructed correctly. This litigation and litigation on these issues are pending in every county, and at least in the urban area, and in growing numbers. The problem is probably not getting better, it's probably getting worse. This bill, 1595, is intended to decrease litigation and to increase the speed of settlement of the pending of these type of cases. Now, I want to explain that a little more. The bill would provide that if a case is tried and won by the plaintiff homeowner, the judge must award attorney's fees. That will take place only if a case is tried. Very few of these cases are tried now, and we expect that very few of them will be in the future. So what is the real reason of this bill, for this bill? It's not to get attorneys paid, because we're already being paid, believe me, by the homeowners. What it does do, and what it's intended to do, is to increase the bargaining power of the homeowners vis-a-vis the insurance companies that back the contractors in these cases. It's been the experience of my own office and many of the other attorneys who represent homeowners in these cases that although the cases will settle, they don't get serious settlement offers from the insurance companies until the cases are very near trial. And I think that's a global decision of some kind, a boardroom decision by insurance companies, simply that if we make everybody go all the way to the wall and spend tens of thousands of dollars on attorney's fees and costs to get there, a certain number will drop out along the way. Of those who hang in there, then we'll settle with those at the last minute. We want to increase the bargaining power of homeowners by making the transactional costs of the plaintiffs part of the damages in these cases. We believe that that will require the insurance companies to reevaluate their settlements in these matters and to settle with us much earlier. There really is no reason to wait 18 months or 2 years to settle these cases. Once the expert reports are in, these cases are fairly easy to evaluate, and there's no reason why settlements can't be reached early on rather than after everybody has incurred a great amount of cost in getting there. That is the purpose of this bill, and we hope very much that you will enact it today.
Thank you.
Can I have another person, sir?
Representative Twelves, if it's very short, because we heard the bill last year.
Yes.
Please state your name.
Thank you. My name is Nancy Cameron, and I'm from Shorty, Minnesota. I'm here today as a homeowner to ask for your support of House File 1595. This is an important property owner protection bill and consumer protection bill. It's vitally important to all homeowners who have new homes and also for people who remodel. And it's necessary to have this attorney's fees provision so that consumers can get the benefit of the homeowner warranty law that we have. From my own experience dealing with the homeowner warranty law, if you seek to enforce the warranty, then you can recover the cost of the repair, but not the attorney's fees. So even if you, and typically to even enforce law, you have to sue the builder. We had an issue with our builder and contractors. We found we had a water intrusion problem, and we asked the builder and contractor and the roofer and the window manufacturer to provide assistance, and they refused to do so. We first incurred the cost of experts to do an analysis to determine what was wrong with the house, and we shared that information with the builder and the contractor, and they still wouldn't help us. So then we had to sue them. The builder, I will point out that the builder was a reputable builder. We had checked their license, we had checked enforcement actions, we had checked references, all prior to building our house. We think that this law will provide for earlier and fair settlements and is very important to protect the homeowners and put them in more of an equal footing. Homeowners insurance does not cover any of the costs of the repair, and it does not cover any of the legal fees that the homeowners have to incur. In our case, we repaired our home. Our home originally was $260,000. It took about $150,000 to repair it. We were able to, and through the whole process of protracted litigation, including failed mediations, we ended up incurring about $60,000 in legal fees. And if we'd gone to trial, which we didn't do, we would have expected to incur another $40,000 in legal fees. And that would have all been paid for out of our pocket. We ultimately were able to settle, and we did get a settlement, and we refused to sign a gag order, which is why I'm here talking, so that I can tell you that we only recovered $130,000 of the $150,000 that we spent just to fix the house, and we recovered nothing on our attorney's fees. So we were out of pocket $80,000 on this expense. You know, the builders, lobbyists, they have lobbyists, and they have, the insurance companies have lobbyists, and the homeowners can only speak for themselves. But I ask that you support this bill to make it fair.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Swelt, I think, is that your presentation? Okay,
yes.
Thank you. Is there any questions on this? Again, we heard it last year, Representative Cole.
Very briefly, and Mr. Chair, I don't recall if we had the discussion last year, but Representative Swales, I'm the area I represent a number of homeowners who have been through this this situation, and it's incredibly unfortunate, and it cost them a lot of money, and their homes, their most important investment is torn apart. I get that. I agree with that, and I think that I actually might be interested and willing to support the attorney's fees piece here, but I guess the problem I have is that it's one-sided. Mm-hmm. And we're changing what is the general rule of American jurisprudence, tort law, that each side bears their own attorney's fees. Now, there's obviously exceptions to that, but can you tell me why we shouldn't make this go both ways? And if we're going to go loser pay on one side, why don't we do it on both sides? I mean, if undoubtedly, ma'am, your claim is real, and I'm not questioning that, and there's all kinds of real claims, but there's also all kinds of insurance fraud that happens across the state, across all kinds of lines of insurance, and that's a real problem, too. And so if an insurance company or a builder decides to defend the case because the builder believes that he did everything right and isn't legally responsible for what happened and takes it to court and wins, that builder has incurred a whole slew of attorney's fees as well, and why should it be one-sided?
Thank you,
Representative Coles, I think you confused two questions into one. One was you talked about if there was fraud, in which case they would be entitled to attorney's fees, and the other was if it was a straight action, I think.
Mr. Chair, my question is why shouldn't it be both? Why shouldn't it go both ways? Because, Mr. Chair, if the builder prevails at trial because the builder believes, gosh darn it, I built a good house and I'm not the reason. What I did isn't the reason that there's a problem, and is able to prove that to a jury, why shouldn't it go both ways? That's the question.
Representative Coles, I was trying to narrow the question because I don't think it's fair to ask her to answer two different questions, and I think the last thing you spoke at is what you're really getting at on this issue, not the issue of fraud. You're asking if the builder hasn't, if neither side's done fraud but you prevail, why don't you get your fees? And I think that's the issue for Ms. Cameron. I think it's Ms. Cameron to... I'm sorry.
Representative Coles, I really do appreciate your question, but there are numerous dozens of state laws where the attorney's fees are paid for by the Representative Simon Hazard. What is it called, Representative? May I ask?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon. I could chime in here. This is the House Research publication, which I've actually used in my own practice. It's very helpful. It's attorney fee awards in Minnesota statutes, and it's not dozens. I think it's hundreds of provisions in Minnesota law where we carve out exceptions. So this wouldn't be unique or new necessarily.
Yes. Right. And I do want to say that, you know, homeowners do not have the deep pockets that insurance companies do have, and I think that they are legitimately bringing this concern. I have hundreds of homes in Woodbury, over 500 that have been identified with this problem. We have many, many homeowners who have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars because of this issue. And this is one tool that we feel would be very beneficial to our homeowners.
Okay. Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Swales, and I suppose this is for the attorney. First, I think Representative Cole's question is a valid one. I don't think he was asking why are we creating an attorney's fees exception. I think he was asking, if you're going to create it, why don't you make it fair and have it on both sides of the equation? The two questions I have are, one, why does it take 18 to 22 months to get a case to trial? In Hennepin County, I know they have a rule that cases are to be tried within 12 months from the date they get filed. and there's discovery that goes back and forth. There are things that happen during that 12-month period, and that's the reason for the 12 months. And then the second one is, we keep talking about these insurance companies, and Representative Swales, you may want to take a look at some of the construction policies, because they have something called a work product exclusion. And when you talk about construction defects, I think the attorney can tell you that the insurance companies have narrowly drafted some of these policies so that it's not just the homeowners who don't have the assets. The builders, a lot of times, are standing there alone as well. So that's why the question I have, and maybe it's for the attorney, I've asked you the one, why does it take 18 to 22 months? But the other one is, why wouldn't we have both sides of this if you're going to pass the attorney fees exception for the homeowner? Why wouldn't you have it for the builder, too?
With respect to the first, why does it take so long to get to court? I don't know. I can't answer that question. Perhaps we need more courtrooms and more judges. It's true that in most counties, once we file a case, and filing is different than commencing a case by service, sometimes several months passes between when you start a case and when you file it. Normally, we will get a trial setting within approximately 12 months, but that, for a lot of reasons, doesn't always end up being the final trial setting. Things get continued for a variety of reasons in various counties. One thing is that judges have to pay attention to the criminal matters and give them priority over civil. And I've had cases, most trial lawyers have had cases where we've been fully prepared for trial and suddenly the judge was not available. So it's not an issue I can address this afternoon or that I think you have the time to hear this afternoon. The same thing with respect to the second question, how about insurance coverage issues between contractors and their insurance companies? There are a lot of technicalities there. There are a lot of issues that can be raised. I certainly don't think you want to take the time this afternoon to get into those. Suffice to say now that the insurance companies are covering these claims. I have not personally had a situation where an insurance company or a contractor declined to settle because of coverage issue, and I think that's probably a fair statement with respect to most of the plaintiff's attorneys that use these things. They are covering them. There may be some putative exclusions in those policies that have not yet been fully litigated. But the insurance companies are not, at this point anyway, so proud of those exclusions that they're pressing them and failing to settle or cases or to pay verdicts when cases are tried. Third question, why shouldn't we go both ways? This is consumer litigation. And you will find, I think, almost all of the cases that Representative Simon incites you in the document. He waved a little while ago having to do with attorney's fee statutes. They are one-sided. They are to encourage and make it possible for consumers to bring actions that they otherwise probably could not bring. I'm talking about civil rights litigation, age discrimination litigation, consumer fraud litigation. These attorney's fee statutes are designed to enable consumers to go forward with their actions where they might not otherwise have the economic power to do so. This is an issue of economic power. When we're bringing an action against contractors in this case, in this state anyway, the contractor doesn't defend these cases. The insurance companies do. And they simply have much more economic power. Their pockets are much deeper than those of our clients, the consumers.
Well, Mr. Jacobberger, you did forget one thing with regard to Mr. Emmer's question about the balancing it off in the issue of a homeowner versus a builder, in that the builder gets attorney's fees on a mechanic's lien, and if the homeowner wins, they don't get it. So on the situation between a contractor and a homeowner, the other issue, the builder has the hand there. So, Representative Emmer, do you understand?
I absolutely do, but I forgive me, with all due respect, I don't see the connection because it's a completely different area. And all I wanted to point out before we leave this issue, I think it's somewhat disingenuous to make it sound as though the insurance companies are accepting these claims and paying them. We have builders on almost every one of these claims that are paying out of their own pocket. And for somebody to come in and suggest that the insurance companies are the ones that are controlling this entire thing, they're the ones that are backing up the builders. I know you do this, and this is your expertise, but I also know that these builders are human beings, and they're paying these claims out of their own pockets. They might have a defense, but when you go to that mediation and they're standing behind those closed doors, they built a house typically in accordance with the building code that's in effect at the time. It's a problem in this state in that the building codes get so good, they sealed up the houses so tight that they didn't allow the houses to breathe, so then everybody suffers. And now what we're doing is we're coming in here, we've got homeowners that are definitely, they've been damaged and they've been harmed. But to suggest that the builders are solely responsible and make it sound as though they're going around putting up sick houses that don't have any integrity whatsoever is outrageous. Right? The builders are in every bit the same vulnerable position that the consumer, the buyer of the house is in some cases. And that's all I was pointing out to you, that my understanding is that both parties bear are vulnerable in some respect. Granted, I think the homeowner probably is more vulnerable, but that doesn't mean that we need to unfairly weight it one way or another. So I would suggest that we rethink this, and maybe one of these days we could sit down and talk about how we could make it fair for both sides with that other issue that you were talking about that might take a long time to discuss, the insurance issue.
Chairman, responder.
Okay, try to make it short. We, again, members, we did hear this thoroughly last year. We're trying to get these through again. There's two more questions, so we're trying to get these through. Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to applaud Representative Swales, and you know, Representative Simon and several other people in this committee do practice civil law, and I don't, but it seems to me these actions whereby we give consumers more ability to bring a lawsuit is really critical, because on the third point that was addressed by Representative Emmer, you know, when consumers go in to buy a house, they aren't in the business of determining exactly what's wrong. A builder is in the business of being able to know what's wrong, and when we're forced to say, okay, where are we going to give the advantage, I would think that we should be able to give advantage to the consumer. When I go in and I buy a house and I have a house built, I don't know all this business. But a builder is in the business of doing that. An insurer is in the business of underwriting where the mistakes could be made and where they're going to have to pay out. So I think it's absolutely appropriate. I think we're actually way behind in the state of Minnesota of giving consumers more opportunities in the cases of attorney's fees. And I hope we see more of these bills coming through this committee.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, I wish there was some way to just balance it off, because I feel strongly both ways. I'm a typical politician, but I'm not going to mention the builder's name, but if you go down County Road 42 in Rosemont, across from the Dakota County Technical College, there's a huge sign that says that they build homes. Some of them shouldn't be building fish houses. My daughter bought one like $300,000, and the nail things popped out in the wallboard, and the door shrunk, and the unstained portions came out, and the floors popped, and they don't have a lot of money. They put it all into the house, and to be able to come back somehow where they aren't disadvantaged putting up with this huge contractor. But then I got a deputy friend of mine that put this little contracting business together, and he's very, you know, scrupulous, and so, you know, it's hard to get this balanced off in my head. I wish there was a way. I don't like the must provisions, but I wish there was some way of going at the big guys that just put these things up fly by night, and they tell you to put little sticky notes on the things that are wrong, and they'll make a walkthrough. It looked like a damn paper drive when you come in there, and we had so many sticky notes up that all the things that were wrong with the thing, you know, and so just for the little person to be able to go back and get it without the must provision, I'm trying to find a balance. That's a long oration about nothing.
Members control
themselves. Mr. Chair, all I'd like to say is I really do welcome this debate and this conversation. I think it's one that all of us want to have. I think all of us want to come to a positive resolution on this. So if those who have opinions that are in variance with what the legislation states, if they'd like to talk with me, and if they do see solutions to make this more amenable to them, then I would be very happy to have that conversation. Okay.
Representative Cornish, you shouldn't have brought on the McCarthy property. So, okay, it looks like Representative, who made the motion? Was it time limit? No, what? Yeah, what?
Well, I'll renew the motion.
Okay, thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Carries. Representative Self, from the... I assume Representative Elfstrom knows her own bill.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1948 be removed from the table. It will need to be amended and then be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Okay, go ahead and make your presentation.
Mr. Chair, there is a DE3 amendment. This bill we've been working on for a number of years. It started with a study group of the courts and the public defenders and everyone. And we reached compromise last session at the end of session, and then we found out that there was an issue for Hennepin County because Hennepin County does it differently than the rest of the state. And so this language just takes care of Hennepin County's language. Otherwise, this is the compromise language that passed these groups.
Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Oh, Representative Weston?
Nothing. Is there a mic?
Okay.
Can you just briefly explain the difference of what Hennepin County does, difference that makes them a standout here?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defenders. Hennepin County provides a significant amount of money to provide public defender services in the county. About $5 or $6 million a year. So this service that we're trying to compromise with, the county's already paying for that. And that's why we're exempting Hennepin County.
Is there any further discussion? Then Representative Hellstrom renews her motion that it be passed and placed on...
We need to adopt the DE3.
Oh, is there an amendment? Sorry. Representative Hellstrom, I see. DE3 amendment someplace in the packet here. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Carries now.
And I apologize. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hillstrom, I didn't get a chance to refute this. So I can understand either Representative Hillstrom or Mr. Kyer, is this expanding the roles that you have in these specific cases as delineated in the bill, or restricting them?
Representative Hillstrom, are you on Mr. Kyer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, what we are doing is clarifying between the county and the state who is responsible for what. Currently, the board is not required to provide counsel to parents in child protection cases. It's all over the map where we do it. We're not required to do it, but that's part of the compromise, if you will, we worked out with the county. So it doesn't necessarily expand what we're doing, but it doesn't necessarily limit us either. So.
Okay. Any further comments? Then Representative Hellstrom renews her motion that it pass and be go to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Carried. Okay. Representative Kalen, I assume those House File 2717.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do move House File 2717. I believe we're going to the General Register.
Yes. Yes.
Great. Mr. Chair and members, House File 2717 is a bill that brought to me by the Chisago County Juvenile Substance Abuse Court Steering Committee. This section of
of our criminal statute allows the 70% of the fines collected from drug offenses to be used for drug prevention program in the county in which the offenses have occurred. Chicago County has been one of the leading counties in trying out a juvenile substance abuse court, a juvenile drug court, with a good deal of success in intervention, rather than prevention, but in intervening in situations where juveniles have started off on the wrong foot a little bit. And it involves the whole family, not just the juvenile offender and juvenile user, and also it provides a real accountability in a courtroom facing a judge, but also gives them an opportunity to show that they're going to be moving forward and becoming productive citizens in the community. With me today is the Director of Probation for Chicago County, Steve McClay, and our Steve McClay, and also our Chicago County Attorney Janet Ryder, both of whom will testify on the bill. I just want to quickly give a tiny little bit of background. Currently, the drug court's mission statement, the Juvenile Substance Abuse Court's mission statement, has been altered a little bit by the steering committee to fit the precise language of the statute to allow them to access these funds. We don't have a DARE program in Chicago County, so this is the only eligible program in the county. What this statute would do is actually say, rather than trying to massage a square peg into a round hole, both of which are about the same end goal here, which is getting our juveniles off to productive and substance-free lives as adults. We're just adding intervention programs as one of the eligible recipients of these funds. I just want to quickly point out at the bottom of the fact sheet that we distributed the fact that we have, of all the UAs that have been done under the program, 98% of them have tested negative, and we have almost 2,400 days of sobriety as a result of the program. I think it's been successful. I've been there for graduation out of the program. Mr. Pequay can tell us exactly how many graduates we have of the program so far, but I've also been there to see when some of our kids have slipped up a little bit and when their family has had to admit that they haven't stepped up to the plate like they should as well. So I think it's a really great program, hope you guys will support the bill, and I'll pass it along to Mr. Pequay.
Mr. Pequay.
Good morning, afternoon. My name is Steve Pequay, Court Service Director for Chicago County. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for allowing us to testify, and secondly, I'd like to thank Representative for offering this bill. As was stated, House File 2717 is the Chicago County initiative supported by the Chicago County Juvenile Substance Abuse Court steering team, of which I'm a member. Juvenile Drug Court was started in December 9th of 2004 as a Federal Office of Juvenile Programs grant managed through Public Safety Department. We're currently in the last month of that funding, and we were awarded funds from the last legislative session through the State Court Administrator's Office for fiscal 08 and 09, and we appreciate that. The purpose of the bill is to, as was said, to expand the distribution of a percentage of the mandated controlled substance offense fund fines to juvenile drug courts. The new funds will be used to meet cash requirements for new programs and to supplement funding for existing juvenile drug courts. There are currently four juvenile drug courts in operation in the state, Chicago, Dakota, Ramsey, and now Brown County. The fine money is currently only available to local DARE programs or drug abuse prevention programs modeled after the DARE program. We're being very cautious in expanding the access to these funds by requiring a new intervention program needs to be a juvenile court program. We also feel that the expansion is in keeping with the original intent of the statute by focusing on juvenile drug issues in the specific county. And finally, I need to mention that existing language is already in the statute that would address any potential problem of sharing the funds between existing programs in the county. Thank you.
Ms. Ryder?
Good Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Janet Ryder. I'm a Chicago County attorney. I'm a member of the Chicago County Substance Abuse Steering Committee. As I can only add to some of the comments that Representative Kalin noted when introducing the bill, our intent here is simply to continue to allow additional leeway to local jurisdictions to use funds that are already in place and earmarked for assisting juveniles who are struggling with substance abuse. Originally, the goal was for drug abuse resistance education, as those programs tend to fade throughout the state. They're not in operation as many jurisdictions as they were even 10 or 15 years ago. So this allows an opportunity for us for local jurisdictions to continue to use these funds that are already earmarked to assist juveniles. So we're not trying to take money away from any successful existing programs, but only to use those that are already earmarked for these populations. And then I don't have anything else unless there's any questions. Thank you.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Sharon. Representative Kalin, I don't have any problems at all with what you're trying to do. I support what you're trying to do. I just have a couple of questions. So the new language on the bottom of page 2, which will allow for the use of some of this money by the juvenile court program, I guess the question I have is, would you be willing to work with me before we go to the floor and at a minimum create some kind of language that requires some kind of reporting or auditing? The concern I have, if you look up on 2.6 and 2.7, I'm not very comfortable with that language there, that the DARE program has to use the money, report and use the money. It doesn't say to whom they report and how they use it with some drug abuse resistance education advisory council guidelines. I don't know what that is. I'm concerned about giving money out to organizations and then never having any kind of idea how it's being spent, if it's being spent effectively. So all I'm looking for is some language that there'll be some kind of reporting or some kind of auditing, so that we as the legislature or the court system or somebody can take a look and say, is this money being used effectively? I'm not saying that it's not or wouldn't be, but I want to have that comfort that we can come back and take a look.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Coles. I'd be happy to work with you on that. I think that the more data, the better. Especially when we're talking about pilot projects, there's things that are in use in a few areas, but not around the state. So I'd be happy to work with you. I think we can. Yeah, I believe that the report would go to the court administration, but we'll double check that and maybe work with counsel to get that language nailed down. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question, probably for the testifier. In this chemical dependency evaluation, is there a mental health component with that as well?
I'll defer to Mr. McQuay, who's been with the program since its commencement.
Mr. McQuay.
Referring to the phases in the...
Mr. Chair, I was looking at phase one and at the chemical dependency evaluation, and my understanding is a very high percentage of these kids with chemical dependency have a dual diagnosis of depression or whatever, and that when you have programs that only address the drug use and not the mental health component, you're really not giving them all the tools for success. So I'm curious, in your initial evaluation, do you look at that as well?
Mr. Piquet.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do. We do a mental health screening using the MAISI 2 on all of the kids coming into the program. And based on the score on the MAISI 2, we refer out for further assessment.
That's
the standard part of the program.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any more? Okay, then Representative Kalin removes his motion. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, say no. Carried. The next one is Senate File 100, Representative Kahn. And while you're coming up, Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, I think everybody knows that if anybody's in the audience for House File 1306, we will not be hearing that today.
I was just going to announce that the chair is going to lay over 1306 by request of the author. Representative Kahn, would somebody like to move?
I will move Senate File 100 and refer it to the General Registry.
Thank you. Representative Kern?
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a bill that we did deal fairly extensively with last year on stem cell policy for the state. The next motion will be to put the language that passed out of this committee back into the bill. The Senate language is different and actually not very good for several reasons. So,
Representative Kahn, I believe you want, is that the DE1 amendment that
yes.
you would like somebody to move, Representative Bigum?
Sure, I will move the DE1 amendment for
Representative Bigum moves DE1 in order to get it in the shape that the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carried. Representative Kahn.
So, Mr. Chairman, this bill is now in the same shape that it was when it was on general orders and was returned because we didn't get to have a vote for it on the House floor. And I guess I would just like to return it to general orders. I assume that we'll have a stimulating debate on the House floor when it's fixed.
Okay, is there any discussion of this? Representative Holbrook?
Chair, just if we could have a roll call vote.
Oh, a roll call on the bill?
Yep.
Okay. Okay.
Do I need to renew my motion
yes.
for you then? I'll renew the motion.
Okay, there will be a roll call vote, Secretary. Or, yeah, Secretary. I'm sorry, CLA takes the roll.
Representative Mullery.
Aye.
Representative Bigum.
Aye.
Representative Cornish.
Nay.
Representative DeLaCorte.
No.
Representative Emmer. Representative Hillstrom.
Aye.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Kalin. Representative Coles.
No.
Representative Kranz.
Aye.
Representative Lesch.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Representative Olin.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Saylor.
Yes.
Representative Simon?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Rustrum?
No.
Representative Kalin?
Aye.
There are 11 ayes and 8 nays for the bill passes. Close to the general register.
Mr. Chair, do I get the honor of the first roll call vote of the session?
Yes.
Maybe in any committee?
Yes, Representative Kahn, I'm sure over the number of years you've been here, there's probably a lot of times we've probably had a lot of roll call votes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there was a roll call last night in Transportation Finance.
Oh.
Okay.
You get the
scepter
of the honor.
Representative Kahn, you're up again. Does somebody want to move 1825?
You know, just for consistency, I will move House File 1825 for you, Representative Kahn. To be referred to the general register.
Yes. Representative Bigum moved the file. I think she's the designated mover today.
Okay.
Representative Kahn, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is something that's much milder than previous smoking legislation that we've dealt with. And I do have two people with me today to speak to the bill from the hotel. This bill came actually not from the usual proponents of this legislation, but actually from the Hotel and Lodging Association. And I would like to ask Dave Siegel and Mike Wojtek to join me.
Mr. Siegel? Is that?
Yes. Right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Siegel. And as Representative Kahn indicated, I'm with the Minnesota Lodging Association. My title is President and CEO of the Lodging Association. We have about 450 members, hotels, motels, bed and breakfasts from across the state. The mission of our members, really, the hotel community really sees itself as providing our guests with the best possible experience We want those folks to come back. We want them to think highly of Minnesota. We believe strongly in the tourism industry in our state, and our hotels and motels become their home away from home. And so in that light, as an association, we conduct listening sessions across the state. We ask our members, what are the issues of significance? And one that came out of those conversations was the problem of guests who smoke in a non-smoking room. It's a fairly substantial problem across the state. So we surveyed the members of our association. We asked them three questions. The first is, what is the average cost to clean a room? The second is, how often does this problem happen? And the third is, can you collect compensation to bring the room back into circulation, back into the rental pool? The average cost is between $225 and $250 to clean a room in which a person has smoked when it's a non-smoking room. It happens on average about twice a month. So if you figure it's $250 times 2 is $500 times 12 months is about $6,000. It's a fairly substantial sum of money, particularly for hotels across the state. And how often can they collect compensation or recoup that cost? Happens about 20% of the time, 20 to 25% of the time across the state. So to solve the problem, we looked at current law and we said, what can we do to remedy this situation? We came up with really two solutions. The first is, in present law, there is a petty misdemeanor provision. We'd like to remove the $100 cap and simply have it read that you could charge what it actually costs to clean the room. The second piece is the establishment of a civil penalty, Bill 1825. So we think this will do two key things. One, it will allow the recovery of the actual costs associated with bringing the room back to rental. And two, it will serve as a deterrent for future problems. So we ask for your support of the legislation. Mike Whitehead is here from the Country Inn and Suites in Albert Lea. And Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd turn it over to Mr. Whitehead for a few comments, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions. Whitehead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Dave said, I'm the general manager of the Country Inn and Suites, 77-room property in Albert Lea. The issue of smoking and non-smoking rooms has become more and more apparent across the state. As Dave said, to give you a little background on just the bare minimum of what it costs a hotel operator to renew that room back into a semi-state non-smoking room, we clean the drapes, which runs about $50, clean the carpets, about $125. The comforters have to be cleaned at $25. Cleaning the blankets that are on the beds at $20. Depending on how the extent is of smoking in a non-smoking room, we throw out the pillows and therefore buying new pillows. So without the loss of room income, easily it's $200 to $250 for an operator to try to get that room semi back into a non-smoking room. That does not include, of course, the problem of realistically of painting the room and washing the vinyl down and so on and so forth. Guests that actually check into the hotels across the state, they know what kind of room they're staying in. They know it's either a smoking room or a non-smoking room. It's very evident on the doors that there's no smoking symbols. There's evidence in the rooms that it's a no-smoking room. Plus, there's no ashtrays. First clue is there's no ashtrays in a room. There's no smoking in a hotel room. When you try to charge a guest $100 charge, one thing to make the committee and Mr. Chair aware of, credit card companies will not back the operators. The $100 charge is pretty much the credit card companies will back the guests, and so you never really collect on that money anyway. In my opinion, we need to correct the issue and take the cap off of the $100 upon conviction and move forward to let the hotel operators at least charge the bare minimum of getting that room put back into what I call a semi-state of a non-smoking room again. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Connor, or the testifiers, so assuming that there's not an objective sniffer, and you can't go in there, how do you know someone's been smoking in the room?
Mr. Whitehead?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, most of the people that smoke in a non-smoking room will leave the ashes on the counter. They'll leave the cigarette butts laying on the bathroom vanity. They'll try to flush them down the toilet, and sometimes the cigarette butt does not flush down the toilet. At my location, we will take pictures of the evidence and keep on file. We also, the burden of proof of smelling, proving that someone, the smell of smoke, if there's no evidence, that's an issue, but most smokers will leave their cigarette containers, they'll leave the ashes laying around on the vanity counter, And it's very evident that if you're smoking in a non-smoking room, that's very evident, especially on a lot of the hotels will have a non-smoking floor.
Okay. Representative Lush.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. So you're saying that if you walked into a hotel room and you saw ashes on the vanity, that would be enough for you to assess the charge?
Mr. Chair, no, there would also need to be the evidence. You would smell, you smell the smoke in a room. Believe me, you walk down the hallway and you can smell the smell of cigarette smoke.
Representative
Lush. Well, Mr. Chair, and by way of comment, I have no doubt that in many cases you can smell and you can make certain extrapolations or inferences based on what went on, but I'm in the business of having to prove this stuff beyond a reasonable doubt in criminal law, and it's rather difficult. And I know that I myself, I've probably slept in smoking rooms before, and I can't tell someone smoked in there. And maybe I'll get emphysema in 30 years or something. But as we know, I can't smell it, so I'm thinking about the proof issues. And I realize, there was a situation very similar to this that Hans Christian Andersen wrote about several hundred years ago, when the princess could feel this pee through all these mattresses. And I don't think she could get attorney's fees for the pain and suffering or emotional distress from that. But that's not in this bill. And I kind of have a problem with it because I don't know how you can establish for a fact that someone was smoking in the room before you walk in there and see him smoking. And so I guess I don't know if it's, we only know if, and I'm not a smoker, and I never have, well, I think I've smoked once or twice, but very rarely, and I can't say that I'd be real happy if someone saw that a guest of mine dumped their trash on the counter and there were ashes in there, that I'd be charged by it in this way unilaterally.
Mr. Siegel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess just two quick points, Representative. The first is this is modeled after the bill that the legislature passed recently dealing with drive-offs at gas stations. It uses the identical language that the legislature felt was appropriate for someone who fills their tank with gas and then drives off without paying for it. So that became the basis for the language that we're using here. And, of course, that provides a provision then 30 days for the customer to challenge whatever claim the hotelier might make, and I certainly know that the members of our association are in the business of making their patrons happy, and they're not going to bring forth this issue in this day and age with TripAdvisor.com and viral media and YouTube. All it takes is one disgruntled guest to cause some significant damage to a hotel's reputation, and so they're going to use this with great judiciousness and caution, and they're really going to use it in those instances where it's very evident that this person smoked in a non-smoking room. Finally, we think by having a more significant penalty established, this will be preventative, that this will prevent this problem from happening to the degree that it happens today throughout the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn.
The comment I wanted to make is that the cleaning out of the room is such an egregious process that people are not about to do it unless they really need to do it. And you can, and I think one of the things is that we've all become a lot more sensitive to what we expect and to the smell of smoke. And it's wonderful to be able to go and just think, well, now it bars everywhere in the state, but that 1 year difference between Minneapolis and St. Paul, it was so nice to be able to go into St. Paul bars and finally and not come out smelling like an ashtray. So.
Representative Fulbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kern, just a comment. Getting rid of any cap whatsoever, I agree that it should be higher than $100, but I'm assuming that actual cost could also include lost income for while the room was down, and so I think that there should still be some type of ceiling to compel the hotel owner to not leave the room open for 2 weeks and wait till the painter felt like getting off the couch to come down and paint or whatever, but rather there should be, there's a lot of potential liability here when you have no cap. You have attorney's fees. You've got the civil penalty. I mean, I don't mind giving the hospitality industry some tools, but I think that it should be measured. And then I'm not sure, how do you prove or how do you determine who's liable for this? In other words, if I'm chaperone for, you know, six kids that are, you know, on a school trip or whatever, and my name's on there you go, and I'm not in the second room and there's some dumb kids in there smoking, then am I liable as the chaperone of these kids for all of these classes?
Mr. Voitis? Mr. Chairman, the way the registration, a lot of people admittedly do not read the registration slip. They just scribble their name and away they go. The registration slip, you would be responsible. You're the one that's signing for that room. It also on registration slips will state the penalty the way it states right now under law as far as what the cost would be if you found in a non-smoking room, smoking in a non-smoking room. So when it does happen, the person that signed the registration slip is the one that we go after.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I think we'd be amenable to a dollar amount as opposed to unlimited on the $100.
Chairman, one of the things I was thinking of for actual cost, except for the period of time that the room is not occupied, except for the loss of occupancy of the room. So we're looking at the actual cleaning cost. And if that's okay to them, I think that's better than putting in some number. I hate numbers in legislation. They're always wrong after some period of time. So if that's, Mr. Gearing can give us some language that says that more elegantly.
Mr. Gearing, do you have language now?
Mr. Chair, you could, on line 1.9, after the comma, after actual costs, insert, not including costs, loss as a result of the room being vacant for a period of time. And the same language would have to go in on line 1.15, after the word condition.
Looks like people are agreeing. I'll try to I believe then that Representative Bigham will make the amendment to, after the word cost on line 1.9, put in not including the cost of the room being vacant, and the same language inserted on line 115 after the word condition. Is that correct? Representative Smith?
If we're on the amendment, I have a question of the witness.
Okay. Just let me get, is that the correct wording?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Smith?
Chairman, thank you. Of the witness, you listed some dollar amounts and referred to them in the restoration after smoking of the, quote, bare minimum of charges. Can you tell me what is the most that your hotel has spent on a room to restore after a smoker?
Mr. Voitis?
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, the most we have charged an individual is $750.
So then, of the witness, under the terms of the language of the amendment, you could be looking at charging $750, another $500 on lighting one cigarette in one of your rooms.
Mr. Voyer?
Member of the representative, that was, you had asked what was the most we've ever charged. That is the most we ever charged. The reason that we had charged that much is because of the burn marks that were in the carpet. The carpet actually had to be pulled out of the room. Most cases, there isn't the burn marks in the carpet. It's the damage that's done to the drapes, the comforter, the blankets. And that's why I feel reasonable as the $200 to $250 charge.
Mr. Chairman, then the answer to my question is yes, you could be charging $1,000 under the language of this proposed amendment.
Mr. Voitis?
Yes, that would be correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kahn?
Mr. Gearing suggested another amendment that's needed.
on 114, the word, can I just let him say it?
Pardon? Represent Con.
There's another, there's a word that's wrong in the bill that Mr. Guerin suggested be changed.
Can you, okay.
Chair, it's on line 1.14, the word retailer needs to be replaced with innkeeper.
With what?
Innkeeper.
Innkeeper?
Yeah, innkeeper.
If it's okay with Representative Bigham, you would withdraw your previous motion and make a new motion, which I'm going to read. The Representative Bigham makes a motion to, on line 1.9, after the word costs, insert, not including any loss of income incurred as a result of the room being vacant during the restoration. Then on line 114, substituting innkeeper for retailer. And on line 115, after the word condition, inserting not including any loss of income incurred as a result of the room being vacant during the restoration.
Thank you.
Okay. All in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Okay, the amendment carries. Any further discussion, Representative Westrum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Khan, I'm contemplating an amendment here, and I'd like your reaction, but as I understand it, they can recover actual costs plus $100 for going through the trouble of having to clean the room and send a notice to the person, etc.
No.
Representative Khan.
Mr. Chairman, it's just actual cost. $100 is sticky. It's just actual cost.
Okay. So Madam, Representative Khan, so right now the innkeeper doesn't get any compensation or can they keep track of their hours that they put in and bill out at a 30 or 50 or whatever a reasonable rate would be, or is it just extra cost for service masters or cleaners?
I've got to turn to my witnesses.
Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, no. The only charges that are charged out are the exact charges of cleaning of the room. There's no extra, what I would call, service charge on top of it. If you have to hire a painter, the painter's going to charge just to paint the room. Your housekeepers are already paid either on an hourly or by a room, so that is included. There is no extra charge on top of
Representative De La Forest.
Mr. Chairman, not done much.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, that gives me even more reason to want my amendment that I'm thinking of, and I'll just lay it out so maybe a House research staff could help put it together. It would be quite simple, and my thought, Representative Khan, is if it gets to the point where it goes to court, if the innkeeper prevails, it seems to me that there should be something for them to recover, and so I would like to see that $100 be available. If it can't get resolved out of court, be another cost that the innkeeper could recover. If it goes through the court process and, in fact, they prevail. If they don't, well, then there wasn't enough proof or it didn't happen, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, one, it would encourage anybody who's violated the law to take the cheaper route of just covering the costs and not going to court and disputing it. But otherwise, it's really going to be an economic equation that the innkeepers are going to say, you know what, we just have to bite the bullet one more time and defray these costs on the rest of our patrons who aren't. So would you consider an amendment if health research staff could give us language quick that would just allow an additional $100 or some fee, I would even say $200 or $300, because somebody has to contract with that painter, somebody has to inspect the room, somebody has to put the evidence together. It doesn't sound to me like we're giving the innkeeper any of this expense to recover. It seems to me $100, if they go to court, it would be an additional cost that could be recovered, would be reasonable, and also incent early resolution to these problems.
Swale. Mr. Swale.
Mr. Chair, I think that actually is in the bill. There's a service charge of $30 under the civil penalty that the innkeeper can charge when they send the notice to the patron that they smoked in a non-smoking room. And then if it does go to court, I do believe there's a civil penalty not to exceed $100 that's imposed if it ends up in civil court, in small claims court. I believe that's the way the civil penalty and service charge are assigned under the legislation.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I think the really helpful, and I'm sorry, my witnesses are the people who have put the bills together. I'm so unused to carrying a pro-business bill that it gets me really nervous.
Representative Kahn, my question was going to be, what are you going to do at the next DFL convention when they accuse you of representing big business?
I know. But the what we really hope is that this is totally preventive, that people, you know, see that this is a serious thing, that this is a serious penalty, and that we will not, you know, as I understand it, there are no smoking rooms, there are smoking and no smoking rooms in most hotels, and it's kind of inexcusable for someone in a non-smoking room to smoke. I mean, if that's the only room left and they're taking it, they just get to go outside and do it. So we're hoping that we're not, that the result of this bill is not going to be a series of court cases.
Representative DeLaForest, do you have something hopefully quick?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just perhaps a comment for Representative Kahn. You know, of course, civil law is all about a simple concept. There's been damage. Who's going to pay for it? This seems a bit heavy-handed to me. I'm looking at towards the bottom, starting on line 18. So you get a judgment against you. You're ordered to reimburse. You better pay up in 30 days. And if you don't pay up in 30 days, the lawyers are going to come after you for the cost of restoring the room to its pre-violation condition, plus a service charge, plus a civil penalty, plus interest at the legal rate, plus attorney's fees not to exceed $500. I mean, I did not come with an amendment today, and I'm not a fan of amending on the fly, but I hope before this comes to the floor, there's some type of reconsideration. It just seems extremely heavy-handed. If someone smoked and ruined your drapes and they had a paper, I don't have a problem with that, but it just seems to me extremely heavy-handed for screwing up and lighting a cigarette up in a hotel room to be sacked with interest and attorney's fees and everything else. So as I said, I didn't come with an amendment today, but I'm hopeful, Representative Kahn, you'd consider throttling back on the punishment just a bit there for this transgression of lighting up a heater there in a hotel room.
Again, this came completely as modeled after the drive-off death penalty. It's actually only, which is very much less.
What?
I
don't smoke. I
just wanted to explain that this wasn't something that we set up. by ourselves. Sure. Okay, so maybe we'll look at
a little disproportional on the penalty.
Mr.
Chairman, I continue to have the attorney's fees problem. I'm not going to go down that road again, but that is an issue. But I the question I guess I have for the witness who owns the property, and I'm sympathetic too. If somebody, you know, messes up your drapes and you incur a bunch of costs, you should have an ability to collect. But can't you right now file an action against somebody and take them to conciliation court if it's less than $7,500? I'm not understanding why this is even needed. I mean, there's a property damage claim if somebody comes in and ruins your drapes and they violated your rule. Can't you bring them to court already?
Mr. Royce.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee. What we do now, right now, is if somebody is smoking, there's actual evidence that you can see the evidence, the cigarettes in the toilet, the smell of the cigarettes. We go and we charge their credit card. They sign the registration slip that says they will not smoke in a non-smoking room. They signed it. They know what the rule is. We charge them the fee to clean on that credit card. 100% of the time, they'll call the credit card company and said, this is an invalid charge. We're not going to pay for it. Credit card company says, okay, take that charge, go for that charge back. therefore, then it's the next step that we have to take. And yes, you know, depending on the damage, the one exception in 8 years that I've run our hotel was the $750 charge. To this day, we have not yet picked up that money. We have gone to small claim courts. There's a judgment against the individual. Small claim courts will give you the, you know, the fact that, yeah, they owe you the money, but it's not automatically paid. So you have that money sitting out on the book.
Representative,
here, I'm not sure that this would result in any judgment getting paid either. We may get a judgment, but you may not be able to collect on it. So I'm not sure that I'm just not convinced that it's necessary. But I'll stop for now. I know we're getting close to being done.
Yes, we only have 3 minutes and we have to leave. So hopefully there's no more discussion. Okay. All in favor of wait. Let's see, whose motion was it? That's right, it's big motion. All in favor of Representative Bigham's motion to pass as amended and be placed on the general register, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
It does not carry. Fails.
Division.
Division, okay, division's been requested. All in favor, raise their hands. All opposed, oh, eight. Just a second. It's yours. Were you going up on it? Okay.
Yes.
You were like this. All opposed. I'll vote for it. The bill passes 9-8. Oh, meeting's adjourned.
Hey, Mr.